Sound check. Right, welcome to the lecture number 6. We're going to talk today about computer forensics, so everything that it has to do with extracting the artifacts from the hard drives, from RAM, how to do it, what are the challenges, what are the, let's say, options, what types of data we can extract, and so on. So this is mostly, let's say, manual analysis. So there are no automation. There are no, like, artificial intelligence that Ajit talked about today. But technically, it's the field that you will also practice in 1 week time with Jeff. So there will be a lab week with Jeff, 3 days this year. We'll publish more information, and all the files will be available on Blackboard. And this is where you will have a lot of hands-on experience. Right, so today, lecture 6, we still have 3 lectures after that. 2 of the lectures will be given by a colleague who also works in Kripos, who's going to talk about mobile forensics, who's going to talk about embedded and internet forensics. The guest lectures, today Ajit talked about AI and malware analysis, and I'd like to repeat that if you're interested in malware analysis later for your master project, for example, please reach out, for example, Guy Rulov, working with malware. If you have any questions from the guest lectures, guest lecture, you can talk to Ajit. So I have uploaded already a video recording from his lecture, and also is going to send me slides. Right, first have some administrative announcements. The project proposals, I've checked all the project proposals, so by now you have selected topic for your project, you have selected the paper that you will present, and also all of the groups submitted project proposals, so very good job. Next deadline, so please have a look at the deadline that you meet the deadline when it comes, so your group needs to upload a paper presentation in a video format. So it can be one of you, it can be all of you presenting the topic of the paper. 10-15 minutes presentation in a video format. Project submission deadline, I have talked to the to Guo Chang Li, who will be grading project, and also you will be presenting to him in the end of November. So there will be 2 days of presentation. So normally we do it, like, for example, Wednesday, Thursday. So we'll see. It will be either week 46 or 47. It's just the presentation of your project. So your group will be given, for example, 15 minutes, where you need to present what is the status, what are the results achieved, and so on. If you have any challenges with the project topic, so if you don't know where to go, if you aren't sure whether it makes sense, if you're unsure if, for example, your project includes some, like, practical tasks or practical evaluation installation, so please reach out to me, and we can kind of, like, shape and put it in the right direction. So don't hesitate to reach out to me. We can have also a meeting on campus, or we can have a meeting on Zoom, in case if you have these challenges. So the main point here is that you work in the group, and then you deliver this project, because it will be a grade for the project in the end of the course. That will be, if I'm not mistaken, 49% of overall grade, and 51% of the grade will be a grade from the exam. The course book, Computer Forensics. So I hope all of you read the previous 4 chapters and can successfully enter the topic of mobile embedded and internet forensics at later point. Thank you very much for volunteering to the reference group. I know that I've been talking about a few weeks, and now we have the reference group. So what it means that if you have any feedback on the course, let's say curriculum, course structure, learning outcomes, please talk to your fellow students, and then we can accommodate it, you know, during the semester. So thank you very much for volunteering. It's really appreciated. So in this lecture, we're going to talk about collection, examination, and analysis of the data that are normally to be found on any of the data carriers found, for example, in the computer, like hard drives, like, for example, RAM memory, like, for example, USB sticks. And I have to put this remark that, well, normally all of the methods that you will see in this course and the tools, they can cover, for example, 80-90 percent of the, you know, normal computers that don't have any, you know, extra fancy functionality, that don't have any extra, you know, some equipment and data carriers. Of course, there will be this, you know, like 10-30% of the equipment that will be either old, so you need for example some fancy devices to read the content. How many of you use the floppy drives? Wonderful. So they still exist, and actually have USB to floppy drive connectors and devices that you can extract. They also called FDD. So this is the oldest older diskettes that were quite popular like 20 years ago. It's like it was before the CD became, you know, mainstream, kind of, or DVD became mainstream. But technically, you know, you may find a computer that has FDD, and then, like, what's next? So you need to find a shop that sells the equipment that, you know, it can be used to read the content. It's just 1.44 megabyte, but those 1.44 megabyte can be very important and sensitive information. So technically, what I mean in this statement is that in most of the cases, you should be following the normal procedure, except that this is a very old equipment, or it's something new, like IoT, that you haven't seen before. You don't really know what's the format of the data there. You don't really know, like, what's the, you know, the approach that you need to be used to extract the data. Because normally, if you take any of the devices, right, you can open, for example, this laptop, you can open, you know, anything like mobile phones. Normally, you will see a PCB, the board that has multiple devices, right? And normally, you can find some, you know, chips that will be like microchips, like CPUs. You will have chips that will be a flash, for example, EEPROM, NAND flash, and so on. So technically, even though if you don't know the device, by opening the device, you can kind of get understanding what this device is doing and what is the memory capacity. Because all of those chips, they have marking, like, for example, the company name, some kind of ID model that you can Google, and you can get, for example, the manual on this device. So we are talking about chapter 5, so I hope that all of you have the at least access to the book and can read, because it's very important that you read the chapter before doing the exercises and the lab week in 1 week time, so next week, week 14. So the computer forensics, and in general in the book, it's written as a computer forensics, or like normal forensics. It's applicable to all types of the equipment, like computer, laptops, you know, servers, and so on. So most of the equipment that we have in the normal company infrastructure. Of course, there will be some differences. Like, I uploaded the Interpol guidelines on how to do like Android forensics, for example. So there will be some differences, but essentially, you know, the approach can be kind of transferred from the computer forensics to IoT forensics and so on. So we're going to learn about the principles, like abstraction levels, you know, the data that you have on the hard drive, and the information that these hard drive stores are a little bit different concepts. Now, the most common, let's say, approaches that you will see is extraction of the data from the file systems that are normally, you know, to be found on the computers like Windows, NTFS, Linux, XT3, and maybe 4. 4 is more common now. macOS, so we won't talk about macOS. It's actually a separate domain, like macOS Forensics. It's a little bit more complex. There are available documentation, there are available trainings, but it's also outside of the scope in this course. So you can also look into how to do the memory forensics, how to dump information using the tools like volatility, for example, and how to extract anything. Kali Linux that I mentioned, they have some of the tools like Mimikatz to extract the passwords and so on. So technically, by combining all the pieces of information like from RAM memory, from HDD, from network, you can get a whole picture of what has been happening during a crime or an incident. So normally, also Jeff will talk about it next week, but normally when you're going to do a digital forensics, it's very important to maintain the chain of custody or to put everything, to note everything that you're doing, like what kind of software, for example, software versions, why are you using this software, what are the results, what are the artifacts, what are the interesting files. So all the types of data that can be extracted, like in autopsy, I mentioned before, LIMS, Laboratory Information Management System, that helps you to automate this process significantly. The first artifact that you need to be aware of is timestamps. So timestamps technically is one of the crucial factors in concluding the or making the final conclusions before the presentation stage. It can be very important, related to alibi checking, like if the person was using this computer or if somebody else was using the computer during the time of incident or a crime, right? So, like if somebody says that, well, this computer was used for DDoS attack on a big cloud provider, and then the person who owns the computer says that, well, I wasn't there, my cat was sitting in front of the computer. So that kind of like needs to be validated and needs to be stated that, what are the odds that cat actually did this, right? So there can be cases like this. So there has to be a mechanism to check the timestamps. So it's very important to validate the timestamps that, you have perhaps one or two separate independent sources of information. Like I mentioned before, in Arduinos, there are no timekeeper mechanisms. There are no chip that keeps the time, unlike, for example, a Raspberry Pi. So in case of such devices, you need to be sure that you have at least one or two additional sources of timestamps. So like, for example, if you find a link file with the same timestamp to a Word file, and this doc file or Word file has metadata that confirms this timestamp, that indeed it was created or changed at some point, then perhaps you can trust the timestamp, right? But of course, it depends on the case. Sometimes you cannot trust timestamps because the computer, for example, has no log information, and the computer was not password protected, right? So it means that anyone could access the computer and change the information on the computer. So timestamps quite easy to change. Like for example, system clock. You can change system clock. You can change, for example, BIOS clock. It's two different clocks that, you don't need a super special knowledge to adjust it, for example, 1-2 hours ahead or before. The timestamps may be forged. So there have been cases when, for example, timestamps been forged, or the file been updated, for example, or the file was erased and created again, just to put a false lead. It's a general misdirection, you know, in the hack systems, because people used to, or let's say the hackers or people who attack the system, they used to adjust the timestamps so that, you know, it kind of get the story, but in different way from the timestamps. So it's very important to remember. You need to look for the, you know, traces of tampering and time stomping. Like, for example, you know, like if you build a timeline based on the important events in the system, and then you see that, you know, the file, for example, the Microsoft Word file was created and changed before the Microsoft Office system, or let's say the Word was installed, right? So they can be like obvious and less obvious indicators of things that you need to look into the in the system. So if you have no traces of tampering, trustworthy, so you need to think like whether you accept this as a, for example, trustworthy timestamp or not. The case that I mentioned before, I used to extract 10 archives from Wireshare and also additional information. So there were about 400,000 malware samples. And then I extracted just the compilation time from PE32 header. So just the compilation time from the header. And then, you know, like surprisingly, I got things like, for example, if you look at Windows 1.0, it was released in US like 85. That was a mistake. 85. So 85 is here, right? So that is kind of understandable. That part is okay. So we can say that, you know, okay, so maybe the virus was there. And maybe indeed it was created at that time. But again, like that part is surprising, right? So it means that when attacker or malware developer tampers a timestamp, surprisingly, they don't check that it looks trustworthy. It's just some random number from, like, for example, 78, you know, 74, 68, 71. So it just, you know, that they put random number there. But again, like you can also elaborate on trustworthiness, like for example, using this period in time by checking the API, right? You can check if there was used an API function that, for example, only was available in that in 90s, but then it was deprecated, or if the API function was, for example, used that was included, you know, in the specification, like 2010, for example. So it's very, very important to remember and understand those facts related to time stomping. So you need to be skeptical about what tools and what results you're getting from the tool, because at some point you need to put this baseline or the trust. Okay, I trust this event because it was trustworthy. Like, for example, if the person was accessing a server, a web server, right? So you can check that the timestamps of the web page access is trustworthy by comparing a Firefox, for example, history of visits and Apache log from the web server. So if they are the same, then there is a baseline that, you know, you can have validated from two different sources. So it's very important to, you know, to have the baseline, because all your hypotheses will be based on these timestamps. So if you have two or three events that kind of, you know, placed in different order on the timeline, then your story will be inconsistent. So it's very important to maintain this line. So the collection phase, once we got the computer, we need to extract, we need to collect the data. So sometimes it's quite simple, because you have, you know, for example, if you have a hard drive in the desktop computer, just use a write blocker. So you turn off the computer, you take off the hard drive, and then you put it in the right blocker and extract all the data in the image. So that's fairly trivial. For some of the computers, it's not that easy. Like, for example, if you have a Solaris server that is compromised, most likely based on the triage, and then we believe that we need to extract the data. Like, for first of all, very old system, enterprise essential for that particular company. Yes. Right blocker, I will show you a few pictures later, but very good point. Thank you for asking. So right blocker is a certain device. Let's start from the beginning. You use HDD in your computer, right? You two types of cables that you need to plug. First of all is the Molex. Normally in old ATIs, four pins, five volts. The red one, the yellow one is 12 volts, and then the black one is 5 volts. And then you have the connector. It's either ATA or SATA or IDE. So two types of cables. When you start the system, the ATX power supply powers the HDD, and then there is, for example, the MBR, the file system that is being read by the computer, and then, you know, the computer launches the operating system. So it normally on the computer, it works both ways. So something is being read from the HDD and something is being written to HDD, right? So write blocker is a similar device, right? It gives a power to the HDD, but it also prevents anything from being written to the hard drive. So you can only take, or you can only read the data from the hard drive using write blocker. So it's a very common approach. It can be, there are so many companies that produce these devices, but normally you can use, you know, devices like IDE, for example, older SATA 40 pins cables or connectors, and then the newer one, SATA, for example, ATA SATA. So it's just a set of devices that are used in the forensics. So when the computer is off and you have the hard drive in your hands. So I hope I answered the question. So write blocker is usually used for the hard drives. So hard drive like SSD, it can be spindle disk, it can be, you know, all types of disks from 5,400 RPM to 7,200 RPMs, and then SAS disks that are like 10,000 RPMs. So it's just different types of disks, but essentially the interface is the same. Like SATA, like SSDs, they are mostly SATA now. Spindle disks, they are... or traditional disks, they're like ID, right? ATA, sometimes they're called PATA. Older than newer is mostly SATA, like 1, 2, 3 version and so on. So it's just interfaces, like what kind of interface we need to use to collect, right? And then when we're using, for example, a mounting device, we have you know, capability to select, for example, the system, like what kind of file system we are using. There are more complex devices where you can use the source HDD that was collected from the crime scene. You just plug the device, you just plug the HDD into the device, and then you bring the identical, the same model, and then you plug it into the destination. You press the button and kind of moves all the data. So no questions asked, just the whole data is being placed to the source drive. So it's multiple ways it can be done. You know, it's not just HDDs, but also micro SDs. The whole point there is to prevent content change of the hard drive by any means, by preventing anything being written. Because when you boot the system, still there are so many, let's say, files being changed, like log files, you know, like, you know, timestamps updated and so on. So the point is to prevent it from happening. So I hope I answered the question. It's a there are quite many devices, and you know, it's just one part of the picture. We can also do it using, for example, a Linux, so software solution. But then in Linux, we need to first of all ensure that when you plug a USB, for example, hard drive, it is not mounted by default. And second, you need to write in the command line like mount read only this device to this folder. So it can be also done like in the software way. Yes. So that's the right right blocker. So the system can be very complex in general, like if it's a computer, desktop computer, laptop, server, normally just plug you know, your hard drive and you copy all the data. It can be things like, for example, this HP has the BIOS hardware encryption of the hard drives. So it means that if I put the password on the hard drive, I take the hard drive outside to another computer, it won't work because it needs the same hardware/software layer that ensures that, you know, I can enter the password and then I can access the data. So there can be a more complex mechanisms in extracting the data. So there is usually a workflow affiliated with extraction of the data carriers and the data. Like, for example, the analyst shuts down the computer. Well, sometimes it's a good decision. Sometimes you have things running in the memory, so it shouldn't be taking offline. Then we use a write blocker. So as I mentioned, it can be usually hardware, like most of the police precincts, they have these devices, they have a big box with all the necessary cables and, you know, things to be used to extract the data. It can be software. As I mentioned, we can also mount it using, for example, USB connector. But then we need to ensure that, you know, the Linux doesn't help us in mounting these devices automatically. So we need to ensure that, you know, this device is not mounted when we plug it in. So there are possibilities to do it in Linux. Now we need, the next step is to create a copy or an image of the whole device. So it means that if we have 250 gigabyte SATA drive, we need to create an image, a file in one scenario, or it can be, for example, some other hard drive that we just dump everything from the original hard drive. So it can be both ways. Usually it's an image that is being placed into the registry and the MD5 hash sum is being validated so that, you know, we have that, we have, let's say, a proof that it's the same data and data integrity hasn't been changed since we copied it from the original data. So we need to copy every bit because it also includes the, let's say, the Ambier. It has to be bootable if it's, for example, Windows. So we need to make sure that if we copy it, we need to also try to launch everything because there can be some proprietary programs that have own libs and, you know, the runtime environment that is only installed in this machine. So by default, if you use a Windows hard drive on another computer, most likely it won't start. You'll get a SOT, blue screen of this, right? So there will be some kind of errors like the driver's missing or the hardware is wrong or something like this. Way more simpler in Linux. Technically, if you take your Linux hard drive to another computer, most likely it will start without any big issues. So we need all the data on the HDD, like empty parts. So they can be empty parts. Well, sometimes the empty parts contain deleted data. I will talk about it later today, but sometimes we also need to ensure that we have access to deleted data. Like, for example, if you tried autopsy on a certain images of the disks, you will see that, for example, the files that are marked with red, they have been deleted. So when you see it on the computer and you mount the file system, like, you don't see the deleted files. But using the image, of the hard drive, and autopsy, you will be able to see deleted files. So this is very, very important part here. So once the collection is done, it's crucial to ensure the secure storage of hard drives, so that we know that this device is sealed. For example, the seal is not broken. We know the MD5 has some of the devices upon collection. We know who handled the device and what was the time stamp. So it has to be tamper proof. And then we do the following steps. We need to examine the copy, like what's inside this copy. What is the, let's say, the data, any relevant data, any relevant pieces of evidences. The advantage of the copies, right? So why we are not using, why we are not doing this on the hard disks, hard drives? Because you can generate as many copies as you wish. You can have a department of five people working simultaneously on own copy of the hard drive. So that makes it very convenient. Sometimes in autopsy, you can establish actually a collaborative, so to speak, environment where you can have a server with the same, with one image, and then people accessing it and doing some exploratory analysis. So to validate, so step one, for example, if you go to step two, we need to validate that this is a true copy. So this can be done by using a hash sum, for example, MD5, right? So we can always come back to the original hard drive that is sealed in the back, dump the whole content again, and check if the MD5 hash sum is equal to the MD5 hash sum on the disk that we are using now. So hardware write blockers. So this is what you asked about. There are so many different devices and so many, let's say, different companies that using and producing these devices. It's these are from Tableau Forensics. It's one of the companies that are producing these write blockers. They adjusted to different interfaces. Like, for example, here we have this is Molex, right? This is our ATA 40 pins. This is 4-pin Molex. And then additional cables that you can connect. Like, for example, it's usually a power supply. So there is a PCU that you connect, and then you select which kind of power cable you need to use. So they all depend on the on the application, but you'll have also, for example, SATA data cable, so either ATA or SATA. So it all depends. And then you have some buttons and maybe some screens to steer the process. Like you can do, for example, the copy, so it will copy to another hard drive, it will copy to, for example, to a computer, and so on. So just an example of such device. Right. As you can see, this is a very complex set of devices. So it's like a system. It's a platform for forensics because it accommodates multiple interfaces, multiple standards. It's all hardware embedded. So it's not soft. It's not some software. It's all hardware embedded. And of course, they can be expensive. The normal interfaces that you will see in your lab weeks or later when you will be doing some digital forensics or incident response, it will be ID ATA. They become obsolete, but still, systems from 2010-05, you still can find those, especially on CD. For example, ROMs. So those were using the interfaces quite long. SATA. So normal spindle hard drives, as I mentioned, it can be like 5,400 RPM or 7,200 RPM. RPM. So it can be also, for example, SAS. is 10K of RPM. So it depends on the interface and depends on the standard. But technically, if we have a normal spindle hard drive and then SSD, the data that we will see, those will be similar. Of course, in case of SSD, the mechanism how system writes memory is very different from the spindle hard drive. So if you don't have the hardware, let's say hardware write blocker, it can be mounted in the read only format. Like if you go to Linux, you write mount and then read only flag, right? So you just select the folder, the device, like dev ATA 1, for example, and then the folder, like mount disk 1 or something. So it's very important to maintain the original metadata on the copy, like the MD5 hash sum, the time stamps, who created it, and so on. Now, how many of you know the DD in Linux? It's one of the one of the popular commands that you will face sooner or later if you use any Linux distros. So this is not disk destroyer. It's the command that used to copy the content of the block devices, any of the block devices. Like I can create a copy, for example, of micro SD. So I write, DD off. So the input, what is the input block device and what is the output block device, right? So the output can be also, for example, redirected to a file. So the like image file. So there can be a lot of application of DD, but it's very important that you use it correctly, because if you put your hard drive that you want to make copy of as an output device into DD command, then everything will be overwritten in this hard drive. So it's very important to keep this in mind. So of course, as I mentioned, the acquisition part and the process of copying data will be different, and it will differ from device to device, like mobile phones, tablets, GPS devices, digital cameras, IoT, automobile systems, and so on. Like in most cases, though, you will SD, and sometimes it's called HDSC. So it will be micro SD card. They're quite big now. It can be hundreds of gigabytes, terabyte. Also, the speed of writing and copying will be different. But of course, it depends on the card reader. So if you get a card reader with USB 2.0, well, it will be 40 megabyte per second. So that's too slow. Like you need to have USB 3.1, for example, or something, or 3.2. So it depends on the application, but in most cases, most of the devices use micro SDHC. It was the time back like 20 years ago when you had cars like XD, for example, from Olympus. So most of the manufacturers, they had own standards for using the cars. Now it's just micro SD across everything, and it's not just applicable to the storage, but also the ports, right? The connectors. It will be Type C, right? So it kind of became more or less a standard approach in device design. So if we have a running system? So the running system means that we probably can collect some valuable information. So it's not always recommended to turn this system off if you have a computer running, because it can be full disk encryption. So full disk encryption means that if you shut it down, then you won't be able to read the data when there is no password. So as I mentioned, it can be hardware in BIOS, for example, like in HP machines or other computers. It can be software, like for example, eCryptFS, So EcryptFS is in Linux. That's the layer that encrypts, for example, the whole hard drive, or it can encrypt only home folder. Also, the social media password. So if you have a running computer, there is a chance that there is a Firefox that is running, right? And then probably the person was logged into Facebook, mail client, and so on. So it can be a very, very important piece of information. I will mention later today about Silk Road. What if there was a person logged into the dark web criminal network or a website there? And you can actually dump some authentication credentials from the memory if you have access to the memory using the Mimikatz. It's something that you'll get in Kali Linux. Kali. So please check Kali. So Silk Road, I actually attended one of the sessions when the person working at FBI was telling like 2 hours the whole story in details, and it was a lot of first of all police cooperation, so like US, Australia, other countries. But then the point was also to find the guy. So if you read about the whole case, Ross Ulbricht, so he wasn't using a lot of money in everyday life, so he was quite modest. He was living a very simple life. You know, he didn't have like super fancy cars or super fancy villas. He was actually at the time when he was caught, he was sitting in the library, and then 2 police officers, they staged a conflict. So he was distracted, and then there was a team already taking his laptop, right, in the good hands, so that they can process all the information. And then first thing that they saw, it was Frosty. So the nickname that was used by him in on the dark web websites. And subsequently, they also saw the IRC or the chats that he was using, and they were able to enter to the website. So it's very important to keep system running, because if they put it to off, for example, mode, right? Then we won't have any anything technically. It's all encrypted, so there won't be a possibility to restore. And he won't say anything, right? So he'll say just it's encrypted. So I don't know. Maybe it's not even my laptop. But then they had a lot of background information that were put together, and in this way they could perform this linkage of the facts and the timeline. Right. Sometimes there are challenges with data amount. It's more on the side of amount of data and things like big data. We can say it's related to big data. Sometimes it's not enough time to make a full disk image, because you know they can be large. Right. They can be, I don't know, using, for example, part of the information stored in the cloud, so we don't have access. There can be also too many systems. Like, what if the enterprise has hundreds of PCs? I'm not talking thousands, but even hundreds of PCs, it will be a super complex scenario there. You need to go to each of the computer, you know. First, unscrew the cover of the cabinet. Take the hard drive, label it, you know, write something on the label, then you know, copy all the data. So it will be an enormous case. And sometimes the cloud forensics, I know that some of you have chosen this topic, so cloud-based data, the data is somewhere, so we don't know if the data trustworthy, if we can use this data, but luckily there are tools like Google Rapid Response. We also would like to have a RAM copy for example, malware incident response, because sometimes the malware, they only persist in the RAM memory, but they don't exist on the disk, so they don't, like, fileless, they don't put anything on the disk. Now, so we got our data image, we got our let's say, copy of the hard drive. So what's next? It's not that like we are immediately looking into the files. You know, we have a Windows partition, and then we start going through the files. It's not exactly, you know, at that level, because we need to look into a bit broader picture. It's an HDD image. There are a lot of information. It's not just Windows partition and TFS partition. There can be more. So for this, we use things like, for example, Redline, Lime, FTK Imager, Sluskit, Autopsy. We need to preserve the data, metadata. And of course, we need to document everything that was done. So like Hanscan, Autopsy, they offer a huge functionality when it comes to LIMS, Laboratory Information Management System. We have to be aware of multiple, let's say, data abstraction levels. So it can be MFT, right, regions. It can be Windows register hives. So it all depends on where and how we look at the data. Of course, the easiest way to go all the way up in the abstraction stack and start, you know, going through the, for example, Office documents. But we also need to look at the hard drive. So we need to look into the memory, if there is a possibility, if the computer was on. So technically, in some of the cases, we can apply the same types of tools that can help us to understand and, you know, analyze the data, all things like volatility. It helps a lot to have the process list, like what were the processes that the computer was running. So of course there are affiliated challenges, and for example, the complexity of doing a hard drive content analysis is considerably low in comparison to when you start doing a RAM snapshot or RAM copy analysis. So like, for example, to dump the memory, we need some kind of program that should be run in the memory to dump everything, even protected, for example, processes. Of course, you need to have, for example, admin access or root access to see all the details and content of the process. But even though you have a list of processes, like in Linux, you have just, you know, PID, process ID, and what's next? Like, you need to have some clues. What are you doing? What are the keywords that you're searching for, and so on. So the examination. Now we need to examine the data that we collected. So we have the hard drive. We extracted an image, DD image. We need to do the examination. So it's more like search of the relevant data that can be analyzed later and can be extracted possible digital evidences. So you can either, for example, access a bit level, let's say, representation of the hard drive, but it won't help you. So that's why I'm telling about the abstraction levels. You need to understand what is the file system, what is the property of the file system, if there are timestamps in the file system, like, are they reliable? Like, for example, also there will be an allocated space. Can we extract some data from there? For example, some pieces of bits in the slug space, maybe bytes even. Is it relevant? Can we use this data at some point? So there are a lot of consideration that you need to put forward before starting this analysis. So there has to be an approach strategy. How you approach, what is your strategy, what you're trying to find. So in HDD examination, there are things that you need to consider, like this structure, physical, right? So we have, for example, you open the computer, we have four hard drives. So two of the hard drives can be RAID 0 stripping, where, you know, only one of the or let's say 100% of the data stored on two hard drives in RAID 0. And if you take one hard drive out, it will be just 50% of the data. So you need to be aware of the physical kind of structure. Logical, you know, all things like what kind of partitions we might find. It can be software RAID, it can be virtual, like LVMs, for example. So when you So that's the interesting approach when you have multiple hard drives. For example, 1 TB, 2 TB, and 3 TB. But on the user level, it will be 6 terabyte logical hard drive, right? So it's the way to put multiple hard drives together, and then it will be seen by the user and by the operating system programs as a single logical hard drive. But then when you look at the system, you open the cabinet, in a matter of fact, you don't see any 6 terabytes hard drive. You'll see only maximum 3 terabytes hard drive. So that's the thing that you need to be aware of. File systems, a lot of different formats, like all types of file system, versions of the file systems, and so on. Can be even multiple file systems if you have a dual boot option on the computer. So some of the file systems, they're very much tied to the operating system, like ext4, ext3. Some systems are more universal, like FAT. So it can be older Windows, like 3.195, or it can be a micro SD, for example, or USB flash, some older USB flash. So you have to be aware of such variations in the file systems. So usually, if it's commonly accepted standard like FAT and TFS, they're very they have good documentation. They have some tools that you can apply against the file system to read, for example, slack space, or to do the analysis. But sometimes they're not very well documented, like some IoT proprietary, for example, file systems. When it comes to RAM or the main memory, variations or type, of course it's a memory that exists milliseconds, microseconds, maybe hours. So it's not supposed to survive after shutdown. Have you thought about how much memory your GPU has? So that also can be considered as a space. But on normal computers with embedded graphics, there is also a shared memory. For example, 128 megabytes that is used by the graphical controller in the RAM of your computer. If you go 20 years back, 15 years back, there was certain limitations, there was certain evolution of the way how processes being run, how computers were configured. Like, for example, in Windows, like 98, 95, there was a config.cc. You can read about this file. There was a configuration. So actually, you can say to the computer that if it's more than 440 kilobyte of RAM, that considered now super low, but at that time it was super big. You still can, for example, assign that please use so much heap memory, so many processes, and so on. So you could configure the way how the operating system was interacting with the RAM. So it's very much volatile. You'll probably read a lot about RAM in the volatility, or if you, let's say, plan to do something with the RAM, just have a look at the volatility. So that's one of the most powerful tools. And of course, there are so many, when it comes to disk, there are so many different standards, like traditional spinning thing. So this is the most common hard drives used for most of the data storage archival application, like web services. For application requirement, where requirement is speed, is usually SSD that have smaller size, but they can deliver data very fast. Like if you take, for example, ATA interface, it's like 40 megabytes per second. So SSDs can be like 500 megabytes per second, right? So you can see the difference. But also the difference when you start making a read-only copy of the hard drive, so that there will be a considerable difference. Tapes, so I don't know if any of you used tape recorder or data storage. So it's more like a museum artifact now, I would say, for daily usage. But still there are many organizations, like actually a considerable number of organizations that are using tapes for the backup. And the idea is that, you know, it doesn't have a very high speed of data processing, but it writes the data maybe only once. So at some point, maybe you don't even need to read this data. You just need to have a backup. So there is less interaction. And of course, you need to be aware of all previous technologies and types of hard drives and data storages. Like, for example, Ökokrim Technical Library has a book on DOS 4.0, so it's very old operating system. But of course, we're getting less and less those systems nowadays because they've been thrown away, they're upgraded, so it less and chance that you'll meet some old hardware. Right, so let's take a 5 minutes break until 15:15, and then we start exciting journey into the disk structure. right, welcome back. I'm going to go through the structure of, let's say, the abstraction elements in the normal spindle hard drives. So if you look at the structure, I don't know, have any of you tried to open the spindle hard drive, normal hard drive, right? So you've probably seen these platters, the head, some electronics, motor that spindles the plate, platters, and then also some PCB that is usually on the outer side of the hard drive. But normally we have a separate platter, so it can be one, two, more depending on the hard drive, depending on the capacity. It's usually those moving parts that moves, you know, from inner to outer part called heads. And then it's usually, for example, twice as much, as many heads as platters, because you need to read from both sides of the platter. So the terminology that is used, it's the track. So it's just a circle on the platter. That is very very small at the abstraction level, because you don't really see those tracks on the hard drives. It's more like a magnetic. So it's a magnetic system. So it's not something that they write on the platter. And then also the cylinder. So the cylinder means that, you know, you have the same position of tracks across multiple platters. Now, another fundamental, let's say, abstraction is, or region is sector. So sector is just like a pie, you know, just a piece of pie that represents a multiple areas across all tracks, and then subsequently across all cylinders. So historically, the track is divided into sectors, 63 sectors per track. So this is a constant angular velocity disks, that it's the same kind of speed across multiple tracks. It doesn't matter whether inner or outer track. Each sector has usually 512 bytes. So this is again in a kind of abstraction that is used. There are no, you know, physically visible boundaries on the platter itself. It's just a magnetic kind of abstraction. And then they're using cylinder head sector CHS addressing, so data addressing. When you need to say where this particular byte is located, you need to define which cylinder, which track, and then subsequently a sector in this platter. So why I'm telling this? Because we need to have the understanding of layout. If we start, for example, dumping the data from the disk, we need to understand whether it's, for example, some kind of additional abstraction level, or it's indeed a physical representation of the disk structure. So to increase the size of the disk, that was introduced, of course, logical block addressing. So it all depends on the technology and, you know, the time when those was implemented. Now we're into a little bit different, let's say, and more. There are more optimization both in the data writing capacity that hard drives can store, but also a speed. So technologies, you know, they move forward, like from having a constant number of sectors on each of the tracks. Now we have different, like, for example, it's called zone bit recording, or zoned constant angular velocity. So we have, for example, three zones, and then the inner zone will have less sectors than the outer zone. But then the hard drive, and it's usually on the, let's say, hardware level, kind of moves, changes, for example, the precision of how a head is reading the data across those zones. So logical disk structures, we have the partitions, two main types of the partition tables that you should be aware is MBR, Master Boot Record, so older systems, Microsoft, IBM, they use MBR, and there is a limitation in the size of the partition, which is 2 terabytes. Like for 1983 and 90s, there was too much. Like 2 terabytes, it was too much. So, you know, no, normal hard drives in 90s were like half gigabyte, a few gigabytes, but not definitely not terabytes. The GPD, it's the GUID partition table. It's very popular nowadays for workstations, servers. So it's kind of the next generation structure, the logical partitioning system, and it's also backward compatible with MBR. Now, if you go to BIOS in modern systems, you probably have seen this terminology UEFI or legacy BIOS. So you can, in most of the cases, you can select either legacy BIOS system if you have older operating system that needs to have emulation of, like, you know, BIOS MBR, but it also can be a new UEFI. So the old way how the system was booting, we had BIOS that was calling the must boot record on the first bootable hard drive. Then it was linked to the bootloader, kernel of the system, and then all the libs and, you know, underlying infrastructure. The new way, we have unified extensible firmware interface, close the EFI bootloader. So usually, if you take, I don't know, if you open, let's say, a partition or the hard drive from Linux, you will see a boot partition there, a boot folder under the root directory that will contain EFI specific configuration files. So technically, it kind of migrated already to a new system. Then it boots the operating system kernel, and then the kernel boots everything else, you know, the temporary RAMFS, all the libs, runtime environment, and so on. So that's the new way. But also the GPT is backward compatible with MBR. There are limitations like maximal capacity. So 2 terabytes, as I mentioned, in early 90s, it was at least 1,000 times more than the average size of the hard drives back then. So, but now, I mean, 2 terabytes, it's not even serious hard drive, right? It's like, it's too little. So now the new limitation is 9.4 billion terabytes. So maybe in 10 years we say that, well, this is too little now. Like, we need maybe 10 billion terabytes. Maximum partition number, 4 primary partitions or 3 partitions plus infinite number of logical partition. So this is implemented through extension partition. So I will talk about it later, but this is something that you will see if you open older ATA drives, for example, or that have the MBR. The tool that you can use in Linux, free tool called gpartit. You can run, for example, sudo gpartit, and then you will see a logical representation of your hard drive. Now, the firmware interface, BIOS UEFI operating system, well, technically, Windows will have some limitations that are very, like, specific. In Linux, well, like, in most of the cases, you will be able to install, you know, it on the hard drive. Now, the MBR versus GPT structure. So when we go to MBR, master boot record, you will see that, as I mentioned, you can create no more than 4 partitions, so 3 primary partitions and then 1 extended. So first of all, we have the master boot record that links to the partition table, like how many partitions in this form. Now we have the actual partition on the hard drive. So this is something, at least this part, you will see in gpartit. So if you go to gpartit, then you will see it there. Or if you go to Disk Manager in Windows, technically you have also kind of overview. It's not that detailed as gpartit, but still you can see the structure. And then 3 disks, 3 primary disks here. And then if you want to create more disks, you need to create an additional layer of extended partitions that can host multiple partitions inside. The GPT is a little bit different. We have the protective MBR. Then we have the primary GUID partition table header. And then we also have the kind of backup options to store the information about the partition entry. So just in case if, for example, this one gets damaged due to some reason, we have a separate place that stores. So all this information is in the GPT itself. And then we have also the partition, the data itself. So that's the difference. So I can recommend you to look into the GPartit. Like you can run Kali, if you don't have Linux, you can run Kali, and then just try to launch GPartit in Kali, and you will see you know, all the overview. So GUID is the global unique identifier to reference the partition. So there are a lot of combinations. It's 10 to the power 38 possible combinations. So technically, you know, everything will be a unique number if you take if we take all our identifiers. So that's the GUID generator. It uses 64 bits logical block addressing for storing sector numbers. So it can allow a quite large disks itself. And then if there are any errors, like for example, you plug out the power, so the power loss, power surge, there are possibilities to, you know, to fix this this corruption. It's usually on the side of Windows or Linux operating system. So GPT is backward compatible with MBR. So it enables MBR only booting from BIOS. So it starts with the shadow MBR, same layout, same size. So technically, if you have the older system, they should be able to boot, you know, from this kind of emulation layer. So that's the kind of backward compatibility. So modern operating system, if you take Windows, Linux, they are aware about MBR and GPT. So when you start processing and analyzing the data, you should be also aware of such differences, like for example, four partition limit in MBR hard drives. So if you see that there is kind of strange layer, then probably it's an extended layer that has multiple logical partitions in addition to primary partitions. Right, so this is a bit extended picture. So as I mentioned, we have a master boot code. We have our four partitions, like for example, this can be an extended partition. And then we have also, you know, the boot sector for the particular partition, like it can be, for example, disk C, can be disk D, and so on. So back in time, there was a very popular approach, like 20 years ago, to create separate disks, like for example, for the document, for program files, for the Windows operating system. So if you see like those disks, then most likely, you know, the system is a bit older. It's also because like around 2010, there have been multiple computers that had two hard drives or even laptops. The first one was mSATA, like a very small SATA hard drive, maybe 32 gigabytes. That was enough for the operating system. And then you had a normal spindle hard drive. So that was also a case that you should be aware of. So we have all the data and boot sectors for each of the partitions. And then the extended partition. So as I mentioned, it will be seen in at least GPartit as a separate kind of layer that includes multiple logical partitions. And then also it will include like unlimited number of logical drives that, you know, you can utilize. So that's just the peculiarities of MBR. So one of the ways to hide actually the partition was to remove this link, right? So if we remove this particular link, right? So we don't have, so we have some kind of like partition, maybe, you know, unallocated. But technically, we don't see that chunk of the hard drive. So that was a very popular approach in some cases when you have a hard drive. For example, this is your C drive. This is your D drive. and then, you know, some area. So maybe it's just because it was removed or, you know, some other tricks. So when you go to the computer, you only will be able to see this thing. So you won't be able to see that, you know, it's actually more. And in some of the cases, you get maybe, I don't know, 500 gigabytes, while the hard drive is 1 terabyte, right? So if you analyze the data, you mount the file system or you get access to the computer, you see that, you know, we have two hard drives. The accumulated size is 500 gigabytes. But then you go to the properties of the drive and then you see that, well, it's 1 terabyte. That where is the rest, right? So there are multiple approaches how people hide information. So it can be shadow partitions. It can be just, you know, the way to remove the link so that you don't see, or actually this is unallocated space. So that can be a trick. So for us, it's very important to understand, you know, what is the metadata and how to utilize this metadata, and also, you know, how the data is stored. Because one of the actually challenges sometimes is the type of the endianness of the data being written to hard drive. How many of you have heard about little big endian? Perfect. So this is more like the way of storing the data. So let's say if we have just a second. So we have three bytes, right? So the way how you start, for example, this can be counted as a first byte, second, third, or third, second, first, right? So if you have these kind of sectors that you write, or the pieces of data that you write, you need to understand from which side you start. So that's the very important aspect. And also, like in Microsoft Visual C, there've been a lot of API options where you can select which one you want to start. You need to be aware also about the logical structures. Like we have the physical disk platters, but then when it comes to Windows, for example, suddenly you have the cluster, which is 4 kilobytes, 8 sectors. So this is a historical size of the cluster. And what it means that it's a logical, let's say, blocks that can be used to store. It's like if you have a water, just some, you know, some amount of water you want to store in 10-liter buckets. Even if you have 1 gram of water, you still need to use 10-liter bucket, right? So that's the point here, that even though if you have 32 bytes, still it will occupy 4,096 bytes on the disk. So in Linux, it's called, the cluster is called as a block. So that's a little bit different abstraction level. So slack space. It's the way where often we can find some pieces of data. It's technically, as I mentioned, sector is the smallest written unit on the disk, 512 bytes. So each sector, after writing some small amount of data, like for example, this here data, right? It's a very small piece of information. But it doesn't mean that, you know, everything is unallocated. There will be zeros just in the same sector, even though we use a very little piece of space, everything will be zeroed. However, it depends again on the configuration of the operating system. But normally, you just write the data, like if you have so much data, you write it to sector and you go to the next piece of data. But normally, you know, it's not overwritten with zeros, because otherwise it will be too much. Like it will be, you know, too much overhead in writing the data that are not there. So normally you might have a chance to find or to recover some of the data that is still in the sector itself. So this is what we call slack space or a file slack. Also, on the level of, let's say, cluster, if we have, for example, 4 kilobytes of sector, cluster that includes 8 sectors, 512 kilobytes, and then you write only 32 bytes, it will be used whole cluster. So it means that not just in the space of the sector will be some, you know, information left, but also in other sectors that are not used by the file. So the Slack space itself can persist a very long time because even though, you know, you have data that been rewritten, sometimes the data are not big enough to rewrite the whole Slack space. So it means that, you know, if all the sectors were allocated to store this here data, but we have some old data, then everything except this first part will be still available. So it means that we can recover it, and it's very important. Right. Now, various file systems that you find out there is Linux, like ext234. Nowadays, 4 is the most robust and most commonly used operating system. Table-based directory structure. It has journaling, versioning, and so on. XFS extends file system. It's B-tree structure. It has journaling and used in some of the Linux distros. JFS for IBM Unix machines. HFS for Mac. We also have, you know, YFFS and so on. So other operating systems that that I don't name, but they're kind of like Unix Unix related or used in Unix or Linux. Now, Microsoft FAT, it actually was a very popular platform for Windows, as I mentioned, like 95, for example. It was used heavily, 3.1. It was the problem with the file names. How many of you know about this problem? So that was an interesting challenge that you couldn't create a file that has a name more than 8 characters, and the extension of the file should not be more than 3 characters. Like if you take, you know, something like Microsoft, right? So Microsoft is 9 letters, and then, for example, the newer version of the Microsoft Office package or the format, then this file will have a file name that will be truncated because it doesn't meet this 8.3 convention. So that you need to be aware, because sometimes it was like replaced with this sign, like 1, for example. So FAT 12, 16, 32, XFAT, like XFAT is still in use a lot. It's the operating system that's been used for the file system that been used in the operating system, but also in various applications like SD cards, micro SD cards in early stages and so on, and USB flash. So it was all of the USB flash sticks from, you know, 20, 15 years ago, they have mostly FAT. So you also need to be aware, and there are a lot of limitations in this system. Now, the NTFS. So NTFS is de facto, let's say, a standard file system for Windows, at least newer Windows machines like Windows NT after 1993. NT is a new technology Windows. So all the kind of Windows distros that you get is the NT or new technologies. So XP and late, they use NTFS. There are limitations like file size limitations, like you can't store more than 4 gigabytes file on FAT. You have to kind of cut it, and then the same applies to USB sticks. So at some point, you know, it was acceptable, but of course the technology moved forward and we had to store files that are more than 4 gigabytes. There are no limitations on 8.3 naming convention. You know, like you can use the big file names. Well, the big, I mean, it's more than 8. Because in old days, if you create this system and you open it in DOS or early versions of Windows, you will see that it kind of was truncated to 8.3K convention. Now, also there are a lot of abstraction level when it comes to file systems. Like in Linux, you have soft links, hard links. I'll mention it later. In NTFS, you have directory links, alternate data stream, ADS. So it means that there can be more than one data attribute for a file. So this is very important, and this is actually how malware usually stores some hidden information on the disks. So it's about the data attributes. Journaling helps if there was, for example, an unexpected shutdown to restore the system to the point where, you know, it has the most consistency in the data. There is a compression and also encryption available as features. So NTFS, how many of you know that your computer uses NTFS, or how many of you has the computer with NTFS? So I guess most of you will use the NTFS as, let's say, the file system. So on desktops, servers and cloud-based applications, they are mostly Linux. Like 95% of the cloud providers, they used Linux as a standard distro. The main default, let's say, versions of the NTFS were like 1.x and 3.x after 2000. So you need to be aware that there have been different specifications. So it supports multiple users and also quotas, like access control lists and quotas that you can define in the file properties. So the FAT, in that sense, it didn't have the attributes, that many attributes. It was a single user operating file system that did not allow you to create like these access control mechanisms. So when it comes to alternate data streams, ADS, that's where malware are found to store the information that is not visible to normal users. So it has been exploited a lot. There have been some, of course, protection mechanisms. The way how it works, we have stream example.doc, and this is the data, right? So the data that are stored on the hard drive in the file system. So this is all visible, and we have this certain doc file. However, you can add a stream, alternate data stream. So this is kind of a property that is added to the file. But this is visible only to NTFS volume. So that was the way how malware were, you know, hiding the information into these additional data attributes called alternate data streams. Now, moving a bit higher in the abstraction level in the stack, we have all types of the configuration files that helps help us to understand what's stored on the computer, what type of programs, what are the settings, and so on. So in Windows, as you know, it's the registry, all types of, you know, information about the computer itself, about local users, about installed software, you know, what kind of versions even of the software you have there, security account manager, and then let's say the registry is stored in different files. Of course, you can run tools in Windows like that kind of gives you a graphic user interface access to the whole registry combined together. So you don't need to edit all files separately. But of course, you can do it. Another source of artifacts is recycle bin. So sometimes there might be something that was deleted, but not deleted. So it was just placed into recycle bins. Event logs. So it's one of the major sources for of information, like forensics information, because all of the things that happening on the user and system level, especially when it's warning and errors, they've been placed into the event log storage. Now, there are also files like, for example, page file sys. So this is a mechanism called swapping in the memory. So we have paging when you know the RAM creates the pages in the memory. But then when we reach the maximum amount of let's say pages available in the RAM, we go to swap mechanism. So it means that the RAM dumps some of the data into the swap. In Linux, it has a bit more, let's say, flexibility. You can either create a partition, right? Or you can create, for example, a file, and so on. So Linux has more options on how you can handle a swap. In Windows, it's usually a page file that you define in the settings. And normally, there have been some recommendations that you have to put like 1.x size of RAM to accommodate that you have some space left after everything being dumped from the RAM. So it's very important to know about this file because it may create, it may have some information from RAM. Hyperfile, so this is also additional mechanism that is used for example, hibernation when you close the laptop. They've been like sleep mode or hibernation mode. If it's a hibernation mode, that everything being dumped to the file. And then we also have the running process. So everything that has been run in the RAM itself, so all the process list is a very important source of information because sometimes what happens that computer viruses, they use name of the process that is very similar to the default system process. So when you open the process list and you kind of browse, so you don't read, you know, every process name, but you browse just quickly, then you won't see this difference, right? So you need to read specifically each name of the process to find that, okay, this process has two letters S, but it needs to have only one. So there have been some cases like this. Also, in the system, you'll find a shadow service copies. Like, for example, in some laptops like HP's, Dell's, they can create additional kind of backup or restore points just for the laptop. But also, there are let's say mechanisms to store the copies that can be later restored. Why it's important for us? Because we can create timeline and we can see like what has been changing what has been changed across, you know, multiple copies. Okay, maybe at this point the file was created. Okay, maybe, you know, 1 month later this file was deleted. So you can at least see the evolution of the files and who made the changes. Again, if you take the hard drive, you may find page file sys and hyper file sys. They're very important. You can apply, for example, different tools like volatility to extract information from RAM. But also, there is a chance that you might find some encryption keys and passwords stored in the memory. So Linux ext 4.2.3.4 is mostly used these days. But of course, you'll find some older like ext2. The systems, they have very advanced features like journaling, file board name, finer time granularity, like nanoseconds. If you have been using some of the time libraries like in C, for example, on Linux, then you will see that you can get actually the timestamps down to nanoseconds. So it's very much like granular representation of the time mechanism, and it helps a lot in timelining. So the difference between NTFS and ext file systems, we have files abstraction, the same directories, folders. It's only directories in ext. FAT table and MFT table in Linux is inodes and data bitmaps. Clusters in FAT and TFS blocks in ext, So partitions, LB and CHC and LB in EXT4. One of the things that I'd like to mention that if you have Windows machine and then you want to open or you want to mount EXT4 or EXT3 partition on Windows, you won't be able. So it won't work. Luckily, if you want to mount a FAT and TFS partition in Linux, you will be able to mount it, except that for NTFS you will need to install a library. So that's the difference that you need to be aware of, that on Windows, if you open Linux partition, you will see nothing. You won't be able even to mount it. Now inodes, it's also the fundamental, let's say, abstraction in Linux that is related to the way how the files are stored, right? So as you know, in Linux we have a tree structure of the folders. We start with root, then we have, for example, home folder, your name, username, and so on. So all the files are stored in the directory. So there is a name of the directory and link to the inode. So inode contains information like access time, size, user identifier, group identifier, and then also links to the block. So blocks, indirect blocks, there can be several indirect blocks that contains actually the content of the file, right, in the end of the day. So that's the difference from FAT and NTFS systems. Deletion. So as I mentioned, in autopsy, you will be able to see deleted files as I think they highlighted with red, as far as I remember. So the files that have been deleted, they are highlighted with red in autopsy, like 2, 3, and 4. So in NTFS or FAT, the first character of the file name is usually replaced with the question mark. In XT3.4, the direct blocks pointers are zeroed, right? So it means that they just kind of, they're not erased, they kind of zeroed. So it means that, well, technically this goes to nowhere. But indirect and double indirect pointers, so as I mentioned, there can be several layers of pointers, like indirect, there can be also double indirect. So everything will be persistent, so it still will be there. To recover data in XT, you need to have file carving, right? So the way how it's done, you just dump everything and you can look for, some patterns of the files, magic numbers, whatever is possible. So any of you try to use test disk? So test disk is an open source tool that I strongly recommend in Linux. It's in the distro, so you can just install it like on Ubuntu, for example, Debian. But it's a very powerful tool that can help you to restore virtually, anything where it's possible to restore the data. If you have deleted some files or even file system, from USB hard drive, just can plug it, and then the tool will help to carve. So first of all, it will find the file system. Okay, you will get the first window saying that, well, there is a chance that you get an TFS file system. Okay. You accept the change, it tries the change to the disk, and then it moves to the next step, restoring the files. So there are different, levels where this tool can help you to restore the data. So please have a look at the tool. Linux file system, there is a standard that has been developed and that has been used across most of the Linux distros. Of course, it depends on the distro. Normally, all the system files or the configuration files, the registry, you'll find in etc. Like password shadow, account information, hashes, the home directories used, for example, if it's a bash or a sash, interpreters, and so on. Hosts, IP address information, and so on. So depending on the distro, you'll have most of the configuration files stored in etc directory that can help you to understand, what kind of software been installed on the drive. So PROTS, the system information, PROTSync, virtual file system. So if you go to PROTS on the Linux, most likely you will see, you know, a lot of PID, process ID, like 210, for example. Then you have subdirectories showing the content and affiliated with the process data. However, the most important directory for us in Linux is var log. So more in all of the distros like Linux, FreeBSD, you have log files stored in var log. You know, it can be information about logins like auth, also log auth, and so on, like web servers, databases, so they all store logs in the log files. Kernel messages, daily messages, so everything will be in the var log. Now, that, as I mentioned, timeline is a very important tool. So, like, if you do Linux forensics and analysis of the Linux operating system, in most cases, you'll need to look into var log. And there are tools like Splunk that can help, for example, to feed all this data and build a timeline. In many of the tools like Autopsy, you will see filters and ingest models that help you to reduce amount of data that you will be processing from the hard drive from the file system by using, for example, whitelist standard files like OS standard files that are to be found in the Windows. There are known files like, for example, you know, malicious files, right, or interesting files. There are blacklists intentionally created to, you know, quickly find those files that might be a computer virus or some kind of, you know, file that has been compromised before. And carving. So, as I mentioned, test disk helps you to recover the data, not only on the lowest abstraction of a file system partition, where you can actually select the architecture, but also on the level of deleted files across different file systems. So if, for example, the JPEG was deleted, you know, there are several approaches that can be used to restore the data from JPEG. Even though there are no header in the JPEG, it can kind of be used to restore based on the information. So in most of the tools, they have some kind of functionality tool.